forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast. My guest today is Matthew Moody. He's the president of Mental Health America of Arizona. He's the manager of contact center operations, part of the Crisis Response Network. So we're going to talk about his work there. We're also going to talk about schizophrenia and when people unfortunately have psychotic episodes, what happens to them, et cetera. So welcome, Matthew. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Happy to speak about this.
Yeah, if you would, let's start with the background on yourself, and then I want to ask you about your current work and, the work you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm the current president of Mental Health America of Arizona. We're an education advocacy organization that has chapters all over the country. And we really focus on, helping people understand mental health and how to get help for it. And then also doing a lot of advocacy legislatively and just helping people express themselves and understand to get, get their mental health needs met. My career, I am a licensed counselor, master's level counselor in Arizona. Previously, I worked at one of the largest, now called 988, but a crisis line, a suicide prevention hotline. And I worked as a call taker, taking over 30,000 calls, and then ended my career there as a director, where I oversaw the crisis line, our mobile crisis team dispatching, and then did a lot of work with police departments across the country and in Canada, helping them understand how to interface with a crisis line so that when people call 911, they can get their call transferred over to a crisis line and get, help from a professional for the mental health needs or social work needs that they have.
Let me ask you about the calls you took. You said you took 30,000 calls. What kind of calls did you take? I'd like to ask you about that experience. It's rare to talk to someone like you.
Sure, absolutely. So on a crisis line, and now, it's really formalized, structured in 988, which has been an incredible shift in how we deal with mental health in this country. The typical way a crisis call looks is when someone calls in, we try to get an idea of what's going on with them, what got them to this point where they feel like they're in crisis. We do a safety risk assessment. So we're going to ask if they're having suicidal thoughts or homicidal thoughts, if they're doing anything to hurt themselves or anybody else. And if they are having those kind of thoughts, do they have a mean, the plan, or intent? After that, you need to spend some time, once you've established their safety, you want to spend some time kind of helping them feel comforted and heard and validated. And through that, people typically de-escalate. But we go through so much time in our life where no one truly ever listens to us or hears what we're trying to say. And so you want to create an environment where they understand that you are listening. After that happens, I kind of always said it's like going to the emergency room, a crisis line, or having a crisis mobile team come out. It's just the first step. Once you've kind of gotten them out of the crisis or the immediate crisis, it's like, let's find services for you so that you don't get services or support, so you don't get back there again. That's really the goal. So a lot of those calls ended up
This may seem like a silly question, but how much does it take to get for someone to call? Is it an incredibly difficult thing for someone to do, no matter how deep the crisis is, or they readily call for help?
There's a spectrum across the board. Some people it was the hardest thing they ever did. Some people, they were, comfortable and getting help. You see in different cultures and different age groups, people feel differently about things. And then everyone's personal experience, asking for help, it just varied completely. I've had people on all ends of that spectrum.
Okay. So how often are you able to let the person, speak and listen to them and then de-escalate them? Is it pretty reliable that with trained operators that, almost all the time you can do so?
Yeah, for a well-running crisis line, you can resolve the call over the phone without, sending anybody out or calling any other resources, 80 or 90% of the time. Some crisis lines get a little bit higher than that. But, it's a really powerful moment for people. And then when they get someone that's truly listening to them and wanting to support them, they can be quite motivated to get help at that point.
What are the top crises that come in through the line?
I think in our country, the idea of a crisis, meaning you're suicidal, is kind of entrenched in what we think. But I always like to tell people that a crisis is whatever you think a crisis is. So the way that we work in crisis in Arizona And nationally in the 988 lines, the idea is if you feel like you're in crisis, you're in crisis. We're not going to try to put, you know, a limit on what counts as a crisis. So it could be anything from, you know, the extreme end feeling suicidal, but it could also be something that, you know, someone's main support in their life is a pet or a family member, and those people pass away, or the pet passes away. That can be a crisis for some people. And crisis doesn't mean that you have some diagnosed mental health condition. It just means that your ability to cope with your current life situation is being overwhelmed by the situation that you're in. So it's really up to the person. And I think that it really should be that way.
Well, what does overwhelm look like? Is it someone having a panic attack, like they can't breathe, or someone that they don't know what to do? They're just like an emotional, like, blubbering mess? Like, what does it look like or sound like?
Yeah, it can look different for everybody. Those are definitely examples of it. You know, a panic attack definitely feels for a lot of people like they're dying. So that feels like a crisis. If someone's having suicidal thoughts, it can look different ways. They can be frantic and stressed out and kind of frustrated or agitated. Or if someone's in a depressive episode, it can feel very morose and slow and quiet and just kind of, you know, hopeless. So it can be, you know, any type of presentation. I've had people that are in crisis that talk completely fine and were able to kind of calmly explain where they were at, but that didn't mean that they weren't experiencing extreme distress internally.
It's interesting. What kind of crises were easier to handle versus other ones? Which ones seemed to be the most difficult?
That's a good question. I don't know if it ever felt like it was easy. I think that every human is going through a different life experience. You know, their lived experience is completely different from everyone else's, even if you, you know, even two twins can have completely different life experiences, right? So it was really a matter of, you know, helping them establish safety and helping them understand that there's someone there that's going to help them, and then trying to find the right support that person needed to feel, you know, more de-escalated and like they're getting the support that they need. So it was always kind of like a puzzle a little bit, in that you just really need to find out what they need and speak to them in the way that they need. And that can be difficult over the phone with someone that you've never met before, right? So it was really just about trying out different ways of communicating until you found the one that worked for them. And so that could be different clinical techniques. It could be a different volume. It could be some people might need more direction and some people might need more listening. So, you know, there's just a number of different tactics and ways to think about how someone needs to get their communication. And once you found that, then, you know, you typically have a way forward.
How did it affect you? You know, in the beginning, were you like very scared of talking to people? And after, you know, 10,000 calls, were you, you know, too lackadaisical maybe? Like, what did you go through emotionally, and what did you experience by handling these calls? How did it affect you?
I was lucky that I had previously worked in Arizona. It's called the SMI world, so serious mental illness. So that's a public level of care. So if someone was so interrupted by their mental health condition that they weren't able to function well without assistance, you can get help through the Medicaid system here. And so typically the people that ended up in that level of care were people that, you know, didn't have a lot of strong social supports or familial supports. They didn't have, you know, they might not have gotten a lot of education, a lot of low socioeconomic status. So people that don't have a lot of resources financially to support their mental health. That's where it happened. So, you know, my experience with schizophrenia specifically was working very closely with a caseload of like 30 people. And some of those people that I worked with had schizophrenia. So I came from a world where I was going out and going to people's homes, doing home visits and picking people off the street and getting them to services. So I feel like that experience, you know, we used to get bomb threats and people had drill bits they'd turn into knives, Kleenex boxes thrown at you, like all sorts of stuff like that. So actually for me, going to a crisis line felt a little bit safer in a way, because I wasn't physically with people. And that kind of gave you a little bit more space to work with them, because you're focused on just this one medium of communication. When you're in person with somebody, it can help you build a lot more rapport, and you can see a whole lot more what's going on with them, with their body language and where they're living and how they interact with people. You know, you can tell if they've been, you know, taking care of their hygiene and so forth. So when you're on the phone only, it really narrows your tools to help them. So, you know, I did end up, when I moved to the crisis line, see a lot more acute situations. So I'd seen acute situations before, see the wrong word, but, you know, be involved with acute situations. It's really important for a good crisis worker to have compartmentalization. So you need to understand that you are only there for a brief moment in this person's entire existence. And so the amount of impact you can have is relatively small compared to all the experiences they've ever had. And you have to understand that, you know, if someone takes a choice and does something that hurts your emotion, it hurts you emotionally, it wasn't your fault, right? So that was something that you learn as a crisis worker. If you're in the field for any amount of time, you have to learn to kind of divide your brain into, I'm here to help people, but I'm also not their whole existence. And that 10 or 30 minute phone call isn't necessarily going to solve all their problems.
Well, you spoke about being physically attacked. Have you been mentally attacked? Like, you know, the people you're trying to help, do they lash out at you and say terrible things? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, but you know, also there have been people that I spoke with that died after I spoke with them on the phone, and that's something that happens with most crisis workers. But yeah, there's, you know, the way I always talk about it is we're all trying to meet our.
They died like imminently after you spoke to them, or what happened?
I don't remember specifics on the situations in those. Yeah, so I can say yes, people have died that I spoke with later. I don't remember how far after that. I had people overdose on the phone with me, and then the fire department would, you know, knock on the door, open their door and take them. And so, you know, I don't know. Yeah. But it's, you know, again, it's something that you kind of learn to understand. And yeah, like you can't take it personally. Like I said,
Well, what happens, you know, when you're working with these kind of situations and then you go home and you're talking to, let's say, your wife or your kid or a friend, or, you know, you go to Starbucks to get a coffee and it's just like, you know, it's a normal interaction. Is it weird to you? Is it hard to turn this off? Like, how does it color your interactions with people having dealt with this and, you know, these intense emotional and physical situations so many times?
So you learn to, and so the benefit here versus other first responders is that you actually have a built-in system of counselors and social workers and stuff that are used to dealing with trauma and used to supporting people through mental health issues, right? So you learn these things, you know, you might feel this way, burnout feels this way, you know, you learn what the symptoms are and you learn to kind of move forward with that. And you also learn not to take it home. So that's what I was saying about understanding that these people that called you had lived decades and their problems had built up over potentially decades, months or years, to get to where they were calling you. And so you're not able to take responsibility for everything that they did because you weren't there the entire time that led up to it and you didn't cause it. So that was the big one for me. I don't have a problem talking about it with my friends and family. I always worry that they're not going to deal with it well. So I be careful about what stories I tell people and when and in what situation. But for me, I don't really feel frequently that like I'm upset emotionally from this stuff or hurt by it. I'm really proud of the work that I did and do. And I'm just happy that I was able to be there for them in those times and just have someone that cared and was willing to take the time for them to help them.
You know, has it made you better under stress or under emotional high pressure situations? Like, do you handle them better now?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, especially in like leadership and dealing with other stuff, it's like you learn to regulate your nervous system in difficult situations. You learn tricks on how to handle those things. And between that and some other experiences I've had in my life, it makes me think, okay, you know, this issue with the budget is bad, but you know, I've been through these things before, so I'm able to endure and do difficult things. So it definitely like puts it in perspective. It's really similar to like cops and firefighters that I work with. They you kind of just like, well, I've been shot at, so I can handle this budget situation.
Makes sense. Okay. So in the bio, it talks about schizophrenia. Have you dealt specifically with people that have, you know, psychotic breaks or delusional behavior? And what's that like versus someone being in crisis? You know, now it sounds like we're getting into your current work.
So, yeah, I did work with people with schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders quite extensively. I think that the main thing that I found when working with people with those disorders and those sets of symptoms was that the stigma is so strong. People are so fearful of being around someone that has that or might be responding to internal stimuli, you know, hallucinations, that they don't get a lot of connection with others. And when you really sit down, and this is universal for anyone that I worked with, when you really sit down and try to help them understand that you want to hear them and you want to support them in the way that they need, then they feel they can work with you. And so I remember there was a gentleman that I worked with that had, it's colloquially called word salad. So when people with schizophrenia have these symptoms of word salad or thought disturbance, they are, the rhythm of a sentence will sound correct, so like the sentence I just said, but all the words might be out of order, or the words might not be related to what they're trying to communicate. So it's kind of like the brain is mixing up which words need to come out. And this person had a really rough time with the mental health clinic because they couldn't communicate effectively, right? So it would be like, you know, someone trying to speak sign language, you know, speak sign language. So with that person, you know, one day I was just like, let me sit down with this person and try to understand. And what I found is that if I paid attention to their body language and their inflection of what they were trying to communicate, and, you know, using things like pointing, I started to understand what they were trying to say, you know, and then I could go into their doctor's appointments and help them, you know, quote unquote, translate. And then, you know, they were able to get a lot of more effective treatment that way because they could finally communicate effectively with their doctor. So it's really about just trying to find the mode of communication that they need and then speaking to them in that way. So the stigma is a big one, you know, people being patient and understanding what they're trying to say and what they're intending to say. And then also just understanding that they have extra challenges in interpreting what's happening in the world around them. We're all taking in, I think it's like terabytes of information every second. If you add up, you know, what we're smelling, what we're seeing, what we're hearing, what we're feeling on our bodies, our internal, you know, organs are communicating to us all the time. So we're taking in a lot of information. If you were going to break it down by a computer standpoint, they are also taking in extra information, and that information might be distorted from what you and I might view. I was always told that's called consensual reality. If we're sitting in a room and you and I see each other and no one else, then that's consensual reality. But if it's just the two of us and then you see another person and that person is speaking with you, that other person that we would call hallucination is not in consensual reality with us, but it's still real to them, right? So imagine trying to have a difficult conversation about, you know, your health insurance, for example. That's an annoying, hard thing to deal with, or your bank. And then you have someone in your ear talking about how you're Jesus, or talking negatively about you. Sometimes people that have auditory hallucinations will hear very negative self-talk basically coming through. Like, you're not worthy, you're wasting your time, you're an idiot. They can hear things like that. There's a really great training called Hearing Voices, where you actually listen to an MP3 recording and try to do very basic things like solve a puzzle or fill out a questionnaire. And, you know, after 20 minutes of that, I was having a very difficult time. And so that was a really beautiful training that helped me understand that.
What do you mean you were having a difficult time? What was difficult about it?
You start to get distracted. And then I guess in my mind, the way that I interpreted it for me was that I had these defense mechanisms against being distracted. Okay. And then after a while, you can hold up these barriers for a while, but then as the voices keep coming in and then potentially are something that's like triggering for you, right? So I can't remember what it was that was that. I'm just going to give an example. If you're a very religious person, all of a sudden the hallucinations, the voices start talking about religious stuff, that can just pull you out of that. And so I found that after a while, 20, 30 minutes, my defense mechanism to distraction broke down. And then I was trying to fill out, it's called a mini mental status exam. It's something they give it to you when you go into a lot of psych facilities, like a psych hospital, ask you who the president is, spell the word world backwards, stuff like that. It became very, very difficult. It would take me two or three times longer. I get frustrated. And then, so I can only imagine what it's like to have those voices 24/7 all the time.
I see what you mean. Okay. So they're distracting you, they're demoralizing you, they're like picking at you, it sounds like, in a whole bunch of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to be clear, people with psychotic and delusional disorders don't always experience the same thing. So just because someone's hearing auditory hallucinations doesn't mean that they're hearing some sort of religious fixation, or some people hear things about aliens or magic or anything. It's different for every single person. And some people don't have auditory hallucinations at all. So everyone's experience is different. But for me, with those kind of like typical types of hallucinations that they put on the MP3 recording, they definitely wore down on you.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. So that's, well, I remember I had spoken to one lady who, I've known for a long time, and periodically she would say, yeah, I'm worthless, or I'm bad, or whatever it is. And, you know, one time I had asked her, I said, how many times do you think you said that to yourself? And she got really upset and said, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of times. And so I said, you know, That's a lot. I don't think you would tell anyone else, even if you hated them that many times, something negative like that. So, you know, it's something to consider. I'm not trying to be a therapist or anything, but it just, you know, I guess it fits in with what you're saying. The negative self-talk and voices and all that, if you have them, like I said, it's demoralizing. It's, yeah, I guess it would throw you into despair. It's just like a constant thing picking at you. And over years, I could see it would just wear you down, maybe to the point where one day, like you have a break or you go into crisis. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, and there's an important difference. It sounds like that person you were talking to doesn't have a psychotic disorder or schizophrenia. That was just someone that you were saying negative self-talk. Yeah, so you're really keying in on a good point here. I read somewhere recently that you have like 40,000 or 60,000 thoughts per day, like if you just counted how many thoughts that you had in your head every day. And if whatever 10,000 of them are negative, like you're reinforcing those negative thoughts. The difference here is that the person that's experiencing auditory hallucinations doesn't have a choice on those thoughts. They're forced upon them, and they're automatic. They're not something that they choose to have. It's not something you can say, "Oh, I just had a negative thought. I need to stop that." Those voices are coming at you no matter what. If you're taking medication, they can go away. But if you're unmedicated, they can just go on forever. You don't get a choice on whether or not you're having those thoughts. So for someone with schizophrenia, it can be even more difficult.
Where do these thoughts come from? Does anyone know? And what heightens them or quiets them?
Yeah, great question. So I am not a doctor. I want to say that up front. And I just had a doctor one time describe it to me this way, is that with schizophrenia specifically, it's kind of like your brain is on overdrive. And so there's more electrical signals going on in the brain than a typical person's would. And then your brain chooses to interpret those in a certain way. So, you know, that's why the voices are all different in my understanding, or the noises are different, is because your brain is interpreting it in the way that it does based on its existence. So, you know, you grew up and then you've got schizophrenia. So those like life experiences potentially impacted what the voices sound like. And that's why they kind of found archetypes. But some people don't hear voices. They just hear like train sounds, or like it can sound like static on a TV, or like someone like kind of mumbling in the background. It's not necessarily like clear voices saying, "Oh, you're the chosen one," or "aliens are out to get you." Sometimes it's just noises. But so that overactivity is just your brain trying to interpret these electrical signals, just like they interpret any electrical signals coming in. They just don't have a clear source that you can see, which is different. You know, for people without schizophrenia, we can look around and see where the sound's coming from or figure it out. For them, it's not coming from anywhere necessarily. It's internal.
You know, going back to when you were dealing with people in crisis, and you still do it in a different way. You know, I've heard that there's a common cognitive distortions that could be associated with depression or bipolar disorder or anxiety or schizophrenia, et cetera. You know, black and white thinking, all or nothing, catastrophizing, you know, that kind of stuff. Traditional therapy, I guess without the crisis training you have, it would probably make it very hard to get through to people that are actively in that cognitive distortion moment. Like, how do you think that the training you've gotten and, you know, the training at your organization would help therapists, let's say, deal with people when they're having those distortions, instead of just trying to throw medication at them so they don't have to, you know, they can therapize them or use CBT without that stuff going on?
So it definitely makes it difficult. And that's why a lot of times with something specifically like schizophrenia, that medication is so impactful, so that you're getting rid of, or hopefully lessening, what we call, so there's two classifications of symptoms that you get with schizophrenia. And it's a little bit confusing wording, but there's positive, which means that something is added to the experience that a person without schizophrenia would have. And there's negative, which is you're removing something that the neurotypical person might have. And so a positive symptom, you're adding something, would be hearing voices, right? Seeing visual hallucinations. And then your negative symptoms would be something like depression or having cognitive deficits that are, you know, distractions from the schizophrenia. So when we're doing therapy, we're really focused on, you know, helping people understand their thinking and breaking it down and helping them find healthier patterns. If you're talking with someone and then there's someone else talking in your ear, imagine someone talking 3 inches from your ear and you're trying to focus on your therapist, it's going to get very distracting. So yes, you can make progress without medication for sure. Or if they're having those current hallucinations, you absolutely can have productive therapeutic conversations, but it does create an extra barrier. And I just like to you know, reinforce the idea that every single person is different. So you have to kind of meet that person where they're at and understand what they're going through before you can kind of come up with a treatment plan and see what's effective for them.
I mean, is there a, you know, let's say someone has someone in their family that, you know, has, I don't know, moderately significant mental issues. Is there a training that your organization or other organizations offer similar to maybe like a crisis management type thing that would help people, you know, the lay person better deal with the people around them?
Yeah. So there's a really great training called Mental Health First Aid. It's not from my organization. It's something you can find pretty readily. There's lots of grants that give to organizations to give this training out. And so it's fairly easy to find someone to do this training. But what it is an 8-hour, it's either 8 hours or 16 hours. I can't remember. It's either a day or 2 days where you're working with a group of, let's say, 15 or 20 people and going over what mental health is, what are mental health conditions, what are potentially the symptoms that you're looking at. How do you help people and talk to people with mental health conditions? That is a great place to start. If your family member has a specific diagnosis that you're aware of or is having symptoms that are, you know, like something like you think they might have bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, there's an organization called NAMI, so the National Alliance of Mental Illness. They typically have support groups for families and for people experiencing mental health conditions to go to. They can learn from other people that have family members with those issues or from people that have those issues themselves. That's another good place to go. And then, yeah, if you look at your local Mental Health America website, they should also have resources. One thing that I'm really proud of is all the Mental Health Americas have this free screening tool on our website. So if you go to your local Mental Health America website or the national website, there's a screening tool you can take and say, I've been feeling kind of sad. I want to see if I have depression. And you go through and it's not a diagnosis, it's not a diagnostic thing, but it says you're at low risk for depression or high risk for depression. You should either, you know, go see a therapist or go to a hospital potentially or call a crisis line. It can kind of give you some guidance on where to get more help for what's going on. And there's a lot of different things you can get screened for. So like OCD or anxiety or panic attacks, schizophrenia, depression, PTSD, there's screening tools for all those different disorders on the website.
Okay. So what is your current role? How are you specifically working with folks now?
So currently I'm a consultant and my focus is helping basically 911 centers and police departments have effective responses to people with mental health conditions. So in this country, we've really focused on having first responders be our response to mental health. And they typically don't get great training for that. And the structures were not set up to help people with mental health conditions. So my goal and my work is helping departments find better solutions for people in their communities that are suffering from these different disorders. So a lot of times that is helping them either have a clinician in the 911 center that can, you know, that somebody that's like trained in mental health that can help de-escalate the caller, help them get help for their mental health conditions and not have an officer go out. Transferring to the nationwide 988 lines or a local crisis center so they can get the right professional at the right time.
Okay. Well, very good. Matt, so where can people find out more about your organization, your work? And then, again, what are some of the resources that you probably have stated already, but you could restate for people listening? You know, if they have a friend, loved one that is having issues or they're heading towards issues themselves, they feel, what can they do?
The first thing that I would say is just write down the phone number 988. The goal for this phone number is to create an alternative to 911. Okay, for mental health or for crisis issues. So if you dial 988 from wherever you're at, it will get you to a crisis specialist who's trained in this with an accredited agency. And that's available 24/7, 365, anywhere in the country for free. So that's where I would say is if you feel like you're in crisis or someone that you know is in crisis, call 988 and then they can start to help you. Yeah, so looking up NAMI, so NAMI, if you look up your local NAMI, National Alliance of Mental Illness. That's a great place to get support groups. My organization's website is mhaarizona.org. So if someone's in Arizona, they can get help through, you know, start to get help through there. But those are the main places to start, I would say. But the beautiful thing about being in our country right now is that there's a lot more awareness going on and a lot more people jumping in to help and just better systems getting built for us to get help.
Excellent. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for all your help, all your work, and for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a pleasure talking to you.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius Podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at FindingGeniusPodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.